Okay, welcome. Welcome back. Welcome for the first time. If this is your first time, my name's Kelton Cobb, and this is the third session on the series of Theology and Popular Culture. This morning's session is on the doctrine of providence, and looking at, in particular, commercial advertising for insurance companies, for banks, and for financial planners for retirement. And the kinds of providential itches that advertising scratches. Leading up to that, I haven't done much of this in the last two sessions, but we're actually going to do a little theology this morning. And I want to introduce you to, it's probably familiar territory for everyone in here, but maybe there'll be something new, a kind of a traditional understanding of providence and a history of its fortunes, the fortunes of providence in the last 200 years, because a lot's happened to that doctrine, much of it as a result of kind of both natural and historical catastrophes that have raised questions about how involved God is with natural processes and with events within history. So that's the progression this morning. First, a look at biblical and theological understandings of providence, things that have conspired over the last few hundred years to draw certain assumptions about providence into question, and then we'll look at both. I'm going to give you a mini history of the insurance industry, and then we're going to look at some advertising.
A lot to accomplish in an hour. Okay. The doctrine of providence. Classic formulation. God preserves the world in existence, governs all events, and directs the world to its final end. I still believe that. A lot of people don't in our world, including some Christians, including some of the theologians that I've read. And for them, it really is a matter of, well, you look at some of the great catastrophes of the world, going back to the 18th century and the Lisbon earthquake, which was just devastating to Lisbon and Portugal, drew into question, I mean, there was a massive reorganization, reformulation of both theology and philosophy in the aftermath of the Lisbon earthquake. Because, I mean, many catastrophes can be blamed on human beings, an earthquake cannot. What was interesting in the Lisbon earthquake was that people like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who was a Protestant, by the way, he was a Calvinist, he said, well, the reason there were so many deaths at Lisbon, I think there were 30,000 deaths at Lisbon, and the problem at Lisbon was there was an earthquake which caused all kinds of fires in Lisbon. All the citizens of Lisbon ran down to the coast, to the beach, to get out of the fires. And then there was a tsunami and drowned those who had survived the fires. That raised serious questions about the justice of God. Rousseau was the one who came along and said, well, if those buildings had been better built, there wouldn't have been fires, they wouldn't have collapsed. He found human fault, right? He got God off the hook. Interesting thing. I noticed this too around Hurricane Katrina. We might come to that at the end of the session. How, if you watched even the news or listened to sermons at the time, we were torn between who was at fault. And clearly the outcome was our government was at fault. We're much more comfortable with finding human fault for catastrophes than we are finding divine fault, because what that suggests is that there is no God looking out after us. We'd much rather blame it on ourselves. Classic formulation, God preserves the world in existence, governs all events, and directs the world towards its final end. Three interrelated ideas in this doctrine of providence. First, that God preserves. God sustains all creatures and their distinctive natures and powers. God originally created everything that exists, installed in it certain potentialities. And then God guards those potentialities. This is what we call natural law. So that human beings will continue to be human beings, that the processes of nature will continue to operate the way they were originally set up to operate. That's what this first point is making. God preserves, sustains all creatures and their distinctive natures and powers. This is not inconsistent with evolution. It's simply saying that there is a design. There are purposes, there are systems that were set in place at the point of creation that God continues to oversee and regulate. Secondly, God cooperates with creatures' actions, making every action attributable to both God and the creature. God is still involved, cooperating, enhancing what we do, calling us to be makers and preservers of creation ourselves. Thirdly, God governs. God guides and fulfills creation according to a plan or purpose for history. In other words, creation is going somewhere. Creation has a destination, a telos, an end. And God is guaranteeing that creation will reach that end. So these are the three fundamental elements of a traditional doctrine of providence. By the way, providence, the word, vision, God sees, God foresees, God sees too. That's what the etymology of that word providence is, or sort of more plainly put, God provides out of God's own divine wisdom. Okay, now some ways of understanding providence would include these elements. God rewards the righteous and curses the wicked. We certainly do believe that God has a stake in human morality and that there are rewards and punishments. But within Scripture itself, we can find this passage and many like it. God makes the sun to rise upon the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and on the unrighteous. So in fact, we can't count on that kind of a pattern in the course of our lives, that God will consistently reward the righteous and curse the wicked. Or another way that providence is commonly understood, God helps those who help themselves. Again, not exactly. Hebrews 12:6, the Lord disciplines those whom he loves and chastises every child whom he accepts. So even those that are, according to the book of Hebrews, favored by God will receive a lot of painful discipline and a lot of chastising. And in fact, singled out for it.
You could also quote one of the places where it says, God is the helper of the helpless.
Yeah, so that's a different kind of favoritism. Yeah.
And contradicts that. Do you know where that saying came from, God helps those who help themselves?
No, that's an interesting question.
I had heard it was from Benjamin Franklin, one of his Poor Richard sayings, but...
I suspect it's much older than that. Yeah. Something like that.
I've heard it on the lips of Muslims more recently, so I'm wondering if it comes from that tradition.
It probably precedes both of us. I mean, a statement like that, it could be Greek, who knows. But that's... I'm going to look into that. Perhaps a better place to begin within Scripture is this verse from Isaiah, I am the Lord and there is no other. I form light and create darkness. I make weal and create woe. I, the Lord, do all these things. This is the quintessential statement of divine sovereignty, that everything that happens, God is behind. It's a strong statement of divine sovereignty. Okay, we're going to look at just two theologians. St. Augustine, late 4th century theologian, what he had to say. He's interesting because of the many works that he wrote, the two that he's best known for. First, the Confessions. In the Confessions, if you're at all familiar with this is a very personal narrative, autobiographical narrative, all set as a prayer to God. And what Augustine is discovering in the course of telling his own life story is that all of the false starts and dead ends that he pursued in the course of his life until his baptism when he was in his early 40s He looks back and he sees that God was guiding his life through these many detours, ultimately towards a faith in Christ. That the faith in Christ couldn't come instantly. He had to take these detours to be disappointed by the many promises of life before he could be maturely convinced that God was the only satisfying object of his human desires. So providence in that sense, a very personal sense, that God was directing his own life even when he was wandering away from God. And then his great masterpiece near the end of his life, The City of God, here he's looking at providence in a more much more historical, collective sense. The Roman Empire was collapsing in the early 5th century. The Christians were being blamed for it because they'd only recently, with Constantine, come to be the majority of citizens of the empire. Right at that point in time, just when Christianity becomes the majority religion of the Roman Empire, these hordes of barbarians from the north, most of our ancestors, were attacking, sacking Rome. And the Christians were being blamed by the pagans. Of course, this great empire that has lasted for so long, just at the moment when it becomes Christian and abandons its pagan gods, it starts to fall apart. Augustine wrote The City of God to defend Christianity against that charge. It was a dangerous charge. Because while Christians were the dominant population, they were only barely dominant. Augustine starts looking for the providential hand of God even in the disintegration of the Roman Empire. So even in the collapse of one's own nation and people, Augustine said, we can see the chastising hand of God. So Augustine plants these two ideas within Western Christianity that divine providence has to do both with personal lives and with the great movements of history. Martin Luther, 16th century, I don't need to tell you that. This is a beautiful idea about providence. Calvin also picks up this concept, but I have not seen it in any Christian thinker before Luther. Fascinating idea. I meant to bring over the table prayer sheet, because one of the prayers on that, one of the table graces, reflects this idea perfectly. For Luther, the whole creation is God's mask. This has two sides to it. First, masks can be, Luther loves this term, masks. Masks can be natural occurrences, storms, sun, rich harvests. These are masks of God. God is operative behind these things. But all we see is the storm or the sun or the rich harvest, because we cannot stand to look face to face at God. So God, to protect us, wears these masks. These are providential masks by which God provides. First, through natural occurrences. Secondly, now that was not a new idea. I mean, that was a pretty common idea within Christianity before Luther. Here, I think, is one of Luther's great innovations. That masks, God's masks, can be the way God acts through our vocations. Whether you're a baker, a farmer, a mother, a tinker, a king, a general, whatever it is that is your calling in life, divine providence is acting through you, and your vocation is a mask of God. Beautifully put in his commentary on Psalm 147. What else is all of our work to God, whether in the fields, in the garden, in the city, in the house, in war, or in government, by which he wants to give his gifts in the fields, at home, and everywhere else? These are the masks of God behind which he wants to remain concealed and to do all things. So Luther adds this idea. It's through providence is not, at least the way it's immediately experienced, the intervention of God in personal lives or in collective historical movements. Providence, we are agents of divine providence. We in our vocations, in our walks of life, in our careers, in our callings, are the agents, the instruments of divine providence. And if we fail to fulfill our calling or our vocation, we are chipping away at the fullness of divine providence. Okay, now, from the 4th century to the 16th century, now up to the 19th century, 18th and 19th century, shifts in Protestant theology and the emergence of institutional buffers. The insurance agency is an institutional buffer against the vagaries of chance. Wonderful book on this, although he reaches the exact wrong conclusion. Jackson Lears, cultural historian at Rutgers University, wrote a book 5 years ago, Something for Nothing, Luck in America. And some of the ideas, which I agree with in his book, he traces the impulse, this is fascinating, he traces the impulse to create strategies by which we can buffer ourselves, society, against the vagaries of chance. He traces the impulse to do this to educated Protestant clergy in the urban Northeast. We're talking now, going back to the 18th century, and up through the 20th century in the social gospel. I'll show you how that unfolds here. Coming out of the Great Awakening, 18th century, where you have, you've got these Puritans in New England who have a strong idea not only of divine providence but of predestination, which for a mixture of reasons that we won't get into had led them to be pretty successful and effective entrepreneurs and business people and farmers. Whatever they undertook in life, they were pretty good at, because they were so fearful that they weren't saved. And any small success in life was evidence to them that they were among the elect. Well, you combine this with the Methodist influence, what we call the Arminian influence of the Great Awakening, which is not as convinced about there being some of us being elect, foreordained from before the beginning of time, but with the Great Awakening we have given much more of a sense that we have some control over our ultimate destiny. These things come together and have some interesting effects on the ordinary business of life. According to Lears, and I think he's on to something here, it led to, and this is in the hands of the Protestant clergy themselves. You can read this in the theologians and the preachers of the 18th and 19th century, led to the secularization of Providence. There was a pact. Many of us aren't aware of this because of the 20th century debates regarding evolution, but in the 19th century there was a real pact between the scientists and the religious hierarchy, Protestant religious hierarchy in this country, both of whom were against survivals of magical consciousness. There's this Protestant allergic reaction to magic, to luck. It goes back to Martin Luther, back to John Calvin. This is why all of the reformers tried to put so much of Roman Catholicism behind them, which they viewed as superstition. But there's this lingering Protestant allergic reaction to fortune, to luck, to magic, which led to this idea that we need to take natural forces and historical forces more firmly in hand and not imagine that God or some other invisible forces in the universe will take care of things. So there's a shift of attention from what theologians call special providence to general providence. Special providence is that notion of an interventionist God who is, you know, every day looking down on the whole globe, seeing what's going on and altering something here, altering something there, just to keep things on course. And a shift towards the more deistic notion of a remote watchmaker who wound things up at the beginning, set in place some marvelously self-sustaining systems, natural law, and now it's sort of our playground to do with as we wish. And hopefully we do well. There was that shift, not only among the deists, who weren't really Trinitarian, or most of them were not Trinitarian, certainly they were drifting away from Christianity, but even among the stalwart Christians in New England. A drift towards this understanding of God as the remote watchmaker. This evolved into waves of social reform. Many different efforts at social control, which in the early 20th century we know as the social gospel. Now let me read you just a short passage. to think about this. I mean, I have, for the most part, I may be sounding a bit critical, and I'm going to say some things that are critical of this, but I'm on their side. And here's why. Let me tell you. I mean, think back to the long history of Christianity. In the history of Western cultures, religion, Christianity, has established a multitude of institutions to reflect its values and ideals that were subsequently dispersed throughout the West and have come to be taken for granted as elements that Westerners expect to find in any livable society. Think about such institutions. I'm going to give you a list. Every one of these institutions was founded by religious communities, by religious congregations. Think about such institutions as universities, hospitals, public parks, playgrounds, social service agencies, art patronage, public libraries, urban cemeteries, constitutional forms of government, family law, homes for orphans, homes for the destitute, homes for the elderly. Each one of these institutions can be traced back to some founding efforts by organized religion. They didn't exist apart from that. This is the point that they have their point of origination within organized religion, organized within the church. True, most universities, hospitals, social service agencies, and the rest are now independent, nonprofit, or for-profit, or state-run institutions. But the historical record is that their first appearance in Western civilization in anything like their modern form came by way of the agitations of religious communities who were motivated by religious ideas to launch an institution-producing moral crusade. Well, that's the same impulse. This impulse at social control. We have it to thank for. It's a religious impulse for social control. We have it to thank for hospitals, for universities, for all kinds of institutions by which we take care of the poor and the destitute in our society, et cetera, et cetera. They aspired to align human effort to God's purposes and unfolding plan. So the cooperative component of the doctrine of divine providence. Where we have a role to play. Martin Luther gets some credit for this. We are God's masks through our vocations. Now, it was becoming clear that many calamities were the result of not divine intervention through chastisement, but through bad policy, bad human policies. This made calamity morally meaningful. If we can say, well, the devastating effects of Hurricane Katrina or of the Lisbon earthquake were not because of the natural event itself, but because the levees were not adequately engineered. And some members of our government knew it. And there were some shady backroom deals that were made that prevented those levees from being reinforced in ways that might have diminished the negative, destructive effects of that hurricane. Then we can start spreading the blame, not to God, but to other human beings, to government agencies. The idea here is that once that's the scheme that by which you understand the destructiveness even of natural events, it can be addressed with counter policies, or either counter policies, government policies, or through the creation of new institutions, which are the buffers, the institutional buffers, by which we protect ourselves from each other and from natural disasters.
Is Lear saying that this is something that all Americans believe?
Lear's got something for nothing, luck in America. He's got this, as far as Americans go, we're sort of divided. We're in this tension between believing in luck, which is the opposite of believing in social control.
Right.
And so, you know, you got all kinds of gamblers. The entrepreneurs are the gamblers. They're not on the side of social control. They're on the side of luck, kind of the roll of the dice. And America is the result of the dynamism between people who believe in luck and people who believe in taking control of what's going on.
But that's kind of, I mean, there are, I've just been reading about the Second Great Awakening, Stanley Walker Howe book. And there really are, different groups promoting different kinds of visions of social control, you know? And so that it's a bit sweeping to say, you know, this kind of social gospel movement, what was a wave that went through America, and as a result, we changed all these things that we did. And there were lots of reform movements, and there was lots of contention about it.
Yeah.
And part of it got to be that this was contention that was now going to be resolved in what the state did, what the government did. Yeah. And so how do you know that? That's a huge part of the political dynamic of the 19th century.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Since I'm bugging Bob about this in these sessions, I have to bug you about it.
Yeah, all right. We can talk about that outside of the session. I do want to, I know I'm oversimplifying this, but I want to push this through because this has a lot to do with the history of the insurance industry in America. Okay, and this gave rise to the late 20th century expectation of what's called total justice, which didn't really exist until starting in the last quarter of the 20th century, at least in our experience here in America. And the idea of total justice is, I mean, to give you an example, everybody's owed something. Unless you are solely responsible for a calamity in your life, then you do have the right to look around and see, okay, who put me in this position? Who are the various parties that caused this hardship in my life? And what kind of legal recourse do I have to get some kind of compensation from them? I mean, that's a last quarter of the 20th century notion of total justice. The World Trade Center, when it was attacked and collapsed, there was an attempt by some attorneys at a class action suit against the architects of the building, so that they needed to pay out hundreds of millions of dollars to the victims and their survivors. And that's part of the notion of total justice, that I really have a right, a human right, not to experience hardship. And unless I am the sole cause of any hardship I experience in life, then somebody owes me something.
That's part of the struggle within the healthcare community, especially with births and obstetrics, is, you know, talking about physicians, the sense that it needs to turn out just right. And if it doesn't turn out just right, in other words, the idea of the baby I was going to have, somebody's at fault.
Yeah.
And somebody needs to be held accountable for that.
Right.
Well, maybe me, maybe you, maybe pediatrician, whatever, but gotta.
Yeah.
And that's part of what makes obstetrics, the insurance, so expensive. It sounds like it's connected.
Yeah, it is total justice. Yeah. And we do know so much about what our ancestors did, and that is the kinds of causes that do cause hardships, you know, the kinds of preservatives that are put into our foods. You know, now a bartender who serves one drink too many has certain legal responsibilities. I mean, that's what it all. Those are all elements of this sense of total justice that we are owed. Well, who? I mean, theologically, traditionally, who owes us total justice? God. And now we're looking to a system that's overseen by corporations and the government, they're that now to be the providers of total justice. Okay, some of the providential buffers that we've erected over time, real concrete things. Deposit banking, where, you know, insured deposit banking, where you know that even if the bank goes belly up, the government is guaranteeing the monies that you have there. Insurance, we're going to talk a lot more about that. The American Red Cross. These are organizations that have been formed in order to buffer us, to protect us from all the vagaries of existence. The U.S. Geological Survey was established largely to figure out how to predict when earthquakes can occur. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, the California Seismic Safety Commission, which has an alert system to report, you know, to alert the public as soon as there is any kind of dangerous seismic activity along the coastline. The California Contractors State License Board, which was created in order to ensure that buildings were being built that were earthquake resistant. The Institute for Business, Home, and Safety. Very concrete institutions and organizations have been formed to buffer us from natural catastrophes, most of them. These have contributed to the diminishment of human misery. There's no question about that. Much of the relief of suffering does, in fact, rest in our hands. And we've learned to control nature, according to Lear's, in ways that only the gods could have imagined. Through policy, through organizations, through institutions, through science, through technology, etc. Okay, the theological significance of this emergence of institutional buffers. First, in this process, and put in its best light, we came to view ourselves as cooperators in our own redemption, remaking the world alongside God to compensate for its corruption at our own hands. Right? So much of what goes wrong really has to do with human corruption. In its worst light, we have become idolaters. We've become pragmatic agnostics who are not dependent upon God for our material well-being. The existence of God is really irrelevant to whether or not we'll get through life in a reasonable way. And it's both of those things. It's ambiguous. It's both of those things. And we can, within ourselves, we tend to lean in one direction or the other, but none of us, unless you really unplug from the grid, none of us is immune to the possibility of idolatry. Okay, now very quickly, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but insurance does have a history, and there was no insurance going back to the classic world or in the medieval world. The first kind of organized insurance was marine insurance. That was to protect the shipment of goods, and it was usually the owners of the ships who would sort of pool their resources, create some kind of mutual insurance, so they would all guarantee, look, if your ship sinks, we'll all pitch in at that point in time to help you compensate for your losses. And that kind of reassurance, it really was an incentive to more global trade starting in the 14th century. The next major kind of organized insurance for protection was fire insurance in the 17th century, and then theft insurance, not from your home, but again for trade, overland instead of sea trade. Illness, household goods in the 18th century, life insurance in the 18th century, old age and disability insurance in the 19th century, widow's insurance in the 19th century, and that had much to do in this country with the Civil War, because there were so many widows after the Civil War.
Right. So, just to be clear, by insurance here, we're meaning some third party assumes it guarantees you against risk, as opposed to lots of social arrangements which pool risk.
Right, and I'm going to mention those now. Okay. Well, social arrangements as far as mutual insurance, like the early marine, that's where other mariners say, they don't make payments. They say, we sign a contract, we're in a solemn agreement that if any one of us suffers a loss, the rest of us will compensate for it.
Okay.
When that event occurs. Okay, there is a great Lutheran contribution to this, don't want to miss. Carl Olaf, how do you pronounce that? No, he was Swedish. He was a professor of botany and practical economics in Lund, Sweden between 1812 and 1835, and then he was appointed the Bishop of Karlstad. While in Lund, he founded an insurance company, a savings bank, and a mortgage bank, all of which still exist to this day. That's about the same time that these things were happening here in the United States as well. Now, as far as what John's referring to, the churches actually, before there was organized insurance, if you were a member in good standing of a church in Europe or here in the United States, up through the 17th century, particularly if you were a victim of something, a very common disaster, a fire, so your home burns, you could apply. There were formal processes for doing this. You could apply for a church collection. Letters from the victim would be read aloud during Sunday service, and this is not just your own local congregation. You would write a letter, it would be copied, and it would be spread out to many congregations on a particular Sunday morning. this letter would be read aloud, and people would make contributions to the collection plate to assist you. Now, this kind of insurance through congregations served two purposes. One, it was to collect donations to help the person who had suffered the losses. Also, reading these letters on a Sunday morning, these would have been read every Sunday morning at worship, would remind worshipers of the contingency of their own life and wealth. Right? This is an important theological message. Many early fire insurers were actually fire departments. I mean, they didn't, you know, our ancestors weren't organized well enough to have government-funded fire departments. These fire departments were originally private companies. They were insurance companies, and you would pay into them, whether you were a business or a homeowner, you'd pay into them, and there were multiple private fire companies around, and if you didn't pay into any of them, your house would burn to the ground. You could be next door to the fire station, and your house would burn to the ground. Or if your house catches on fire and you pay this company, well, if they're occupied with another fire, your house will burn to the ground, and the other firefighters won't show up. I mean, this worked the way private business often works. That evolved over times where the governments took over the fire departments, and there were fire insurers. Okay, now let's look at some images. One more little piece of insurance history. I'm getting into this because I live in Hartford, Connecticut, which is the birthplace of the insurance industry in America. You've probably heard of the company, the Hartford. Well, that's only one of many that has its world headquarters in Hartford, Connecticut. The Phoenix Home Life also started in Connecticut. It started in 1851, and its name at that time was not Phoenix, but the American Temperance Life Insurance Company. And in order to get life insurance from this company, you had to prove that you were a teetotaler. They changed their name about 10 years later into the Phoenix, and the Phoenix is a fascinating mythological symbol of the bird that rises from the ashes. It's intentional. Okay, now I took this picture just about three blocks from my house in Hartford a couple years ago. Get your reward here and now. Good drivers get discounts up to 40%. Fascinating imagery, the halo. I mean, there's this connection between, still, this lingering connection. God punishes the wicked and rewards the good. That gets projected onto these insurance companies, which are providential, you know, which play certain providential notes in our consciousness, so that now they are also dispensers of rewards and punishment. And they do, too, care about our morality, whether we are drinking while driving, or whether we are talking on our cell phones while driving, or whatever it is. Get your reward here and now. You don't have to put it off. And who is the great arbiter of these rewards? State Farm Insurance. Okay, the logo is interesting, worth looking at. Okay. What is that the symbol for?
Infinity.
Yeah, infinity. The infinite. Okay, well, let's start there. What else does this look like?
Trinity.
Exactly. Symbol that I showed yesterday, the triquetra, which is a Celtic symbol for the Trinity. I think the infinite part of that logo is deliberate, whether the Trinitarian is deliberate or an unconscious thing. Who knows?
Yeah, luck.
It was luck.
Yeah, maybe so. State Farm mission statement. State Farm's mission, this is off their website, is to help people manage the risks of everyday life, to recover from the unexpected, and to realize their dreams. Now, I'm not saying that the insurers are great Satans, but, I mean, come on, that is a formula for what we used to turn to divine providence for. To manage the risks of everyday life, to recover from the unexpected, and to realize our dreams. Both we would look to God for that and to our churches.
Allstate, you're in good hands. Their mission statement, to be the best, serving our customers by providing peace of mind and enriching their quality of life through our partnership and the management of the risks they face. Peace of mind, enriching the quality of life.
And how about those hands looking like the hands of Providence?
Yeah, here's a stained glass window. Here's the Christ child holding the globe. United Way. I think this is Pacific Life. And Allstate, you're in good hands. Now here you go. This should cut close to home. So now Allstate rips it off right from the church, and now the church is forgotten.
Rips it back.
Yeah, it takes it back, but gives Allstate credit for it. Okay, look at these logos and names. Fidelity, faith, faithfulness, Fidelity Insurance Company. Providence, Provident American Insurance Company with the lighthouse, the beacon, illuminating all dangers. Prudential Financial, the rock, another metaphor for the divine. A.G. Edwards, financial consultants, a flame, the wing of an angel, a protective wing, or has it been ripped off from the United Methodist Church? Symbol of the Holy Spirit. And the Hartford. Now, I like the Hartford. The Hartford's religious connotations, at least in its logo, are not worn on its sleeve. And again, it's hard to say whether this is conscious or unconscious, but there's certainly religious connotations here. The heart, the elk, this great horned elk, is a Christ symbol. It's a common Christ symbol in the Middle Ages. The heart was often seen as trampling a serpent on the ground as a symbol for Christ, and the rack on its head was an allusion to the crown of thorns. But more familiar to the Christians in the Middle Ages was the story of St. Eustace in the 2nd century. Eustace was a general in the Roman army. 2nd century, this is before Constantine, before the conversion of Rome to Christianity. During the waves of persecutions and martyrdom of Christians, Eustace was a general in the army. He wasn't a Christian. He goes off on a hunting expedition, and he sees an elk with a cross, a crucifix, suspended in its horns, and has a vision that he and his family are to convert to Christianity. He goes back. He becomes a Christian. His wife and children are converted. Word gets around that this general in the army is now a Christian. Well, that was illegal in the Roman army at the time. He goes out hunting again. He sees the elk again. And this time he has a vision that he is going to suffer for being a Christian. He's going to suffer to kind of a Jovian level. And he goes back. He's thrown into jail. His children are thrown into jail. And then, 2nd century, there's an invasion of Northern European barbarians into Rome. They need him. He's an effective general. They pull him out of jail. They defeat these barbarians. Now they're assuming all along that he'll return to his pagan practices and that they'll free his family. He doesn't. He continues to be a Christian. Finally, they martyr him and his children and his wife. But this idea that the elk has something about foretelling us about hardships, difficulties, catastrophes, in our lives. That's a deep one within, at least within medieval Christianity. Whether or not the heart becomes a symbol of the Hartford for that reason or not, who knows? I mean, many of these deep stories sort of just play on the cultural consciousness. But let me play for you. Here's an image of St. Eustace and the elk and his vision. But let me play for you this commercial from the Hartford. tell me what you think. Oh, is the sound system on? Does anybody know how to turn this?
You have to plug in that.
It's plugged in.
Oh, it's a tuner over there in that cabinet. You just press the on button.
Okay, just
move it. Run and do that.
Yeah, this does help to have the sound on this one.
Ask your financial advisor about the Hartford Mutual Funds, offered by the Hartford, a company built on 194 years of trust. Request a complete prospectus with investment objectives, risks, fees, expenses, and other information to read and consider carefully before investing your savings.
You were at dinner the other night.
At McDonald's.
It's not every day that you find a French fry that...
Okay. So here's the stock exchange, the heart comes in, and I mean, it's almost as if a sacred figure is stepping in, right? Everybody's stepping back in awe at this heart. Okay.
And the waters of chaos part.
The waters of chaos part, exactly. Yeah, the chaos of the stock exchange floor.
Looks it.
Yeah, you're not gonna see the French fry. My apologies.
Oh.
But I want to show you a series now of insurance commercials and see what you think. I'll pause between some of them. You can make some observations. It's queuing up. Storyline in that commercial.
Take care of your Jimmy Band.
Yeah, and how do they communicate that? Yeah, you have this young married couple under the tree, and you see them at different points through their lives. The tree's always there, sheltering them. You're in good hands.
I didn't notice. Does the tree grow?
I've never paid attention.
I thought the scenes seemed to go from spring to fall during that.
Oh.
Yeah, it probably did.
Yeah. Let's watch it again. you're picking up things I never noticed.
I could be wrong about that.
Some people like to pretend.
Maybe it goes from sunrise to sunset.
Right. The tree is the same. The tree gets bigger.
When I get older, losing my hair.
Okay. Did the tree get bigger?
Yeah.
Were there four seasons?
But it was a different tree. It was different older trees each time.
Okay.
Yeah. Just so powerfully embodies the divine. No, I mean, this is what we, you know, when you baptize your child, you're saying, God, take care of my child.
Oh, yeah.
When you go each step along the way, you ask for God to be with you and guide you, and they just so easily put the insurance company in the place of God.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll be there for you. Will I be there? Of course I'll be there.
Yeah, and you'll end up in a good place.
Yeah.
Okay, these next two are about sort of the disasters that can befall us. So really sort of playing to our anxieties and, hey, to get out of this anxious state, what can we do? Well, we can go buy some insurance.
Some people like to pretend a flood could never happen to them. And that their homeowner's insurance protects them. It doesn't. Stop pretending. It can happen to you. Protect your home with flood insurance. Call 1-888-FLOOD-82 for your free brochure. That's 1-888-FLOOD-82.
Okay, you ready to buy some insurance? Flood and fire?
Did you see the flood? Who's providing the insurance?
That's probably government insurance.
Yeah, why? Does anybody know?
No, I think
it's too risky for private business.
It was information about it?
It's really very difficult for insurance companies to write flood insurance because the damage is always so localized, right? So that you need to pool risk. And so in America, insurance companies have gotten out pretty much of writing any kind of flood insurance. And because collectively we can pool risk, right? If everybody contributes, the government then provides provides flood insurance.
Well, and part of the federal flood insurance is a program to prevent more building in floodplains.
Okay, which makes perfect sense.
Good policy. And that commercial aired 3 weeks after Hurricane Katrina. And it was frequently on TV for about 3 weeks. Okay, this next set, you got a kind of a jester character personifying risk. It's kind of interesting. There's actually this kind of figure out there who's causing all the havoc in our lives. So pay attention for that. I'm going to show you four commercials. These are all really pretty funny commercials, but they're all about sort of the accidents of life that nobody can control, except for in the end, insurance companies can't control them, but they can compensate you for them. They can minimize your risk. So look for that in this next set.
Make sure your insurance keeps up. Travelers.
Feel this way?
Funniest commercial ever.
your insurance is in sync, you can roll with anything. Traveling.
Ready with Nationwide Investments, Retirement, Insurance.
Great. We're out of time. Do you want to see any more of these? Certainly, we're out of time. Walk out. No repercussions, John.
I'm 56. You know, so I'm facing retirement and all that sort of thing. And it is funny to look at these, but I'm really glad these things are there. Right. I mean, I'm glad State Farm is going to be there, or in my case, TIA Crap. Right. They are funny, but it's a real blessing to live in a place where you can give people your money, and when you retire, it comes back to you, right? I mean, there really is something to insure.
Yeah, and I'm not questioning that.
Right. But I just wanted to say that.
Yeah, and I'm glad you did. Let's reinforce that. The danger is, however, that this becomes such a buffer that we can forget how precious and fragile life is.
But I think part of what all many of these commercials is about is don't forget that life is really risky, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
there's somebody who can help you with it.
Right, there's somebody who can help you manage risk, but they can't make the risk go away.
Yeah, the irony of that, I was in the conversation right now, that one commercial where it was flooding and they were saying, you know, some people choose to ignore floods.
Yeah.
The irony is that, I'll go get the insurance so I can ignore, so I don't have to.
Right.
Then I can ignore all the risk. It's not really me. I'm not really at risk anymore.
Right.
And you can. So it's kind of that set. I think that the hook is
security.
The part is, you know, where does one's security lie?
Yeah.
And clearly, it's interconnected with all those relationships. And yet, they're all, you know, are they dependent upon God, or could we let those go? You know. And what does that really mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's challenging. It raises a question of where will I find what my
insurance. Is it better that we have a system where we can make these contractual obligations to recoup to reimburse us financially, or would it be better, even if it's not realistic, for us to live in a place where people look after each other when there's a disaster in some corner? And we relied on people rather than contracts.
Well, but that still happens, even with the contracts. We've had several disasters in our community in the last year where even though there was insurance for a house that was taken by fire, the Christian community reaching out to that family immediately in a time of need to help provide for them until the insurance gets all sorted out was something that they saw as an answer to prayer, as the way that God was caring for them. I could quote other disasters.
An insurance company never wants to insure your house for more than it's worth.
Right.
Because then all of a sudden you have a strong incentive to burn your house down. Right. I mean, it's a complicated set of arrangements in which, it's never going to
happen. Insurance is, in one sense, also an organized way for communities to get together to help each other.
Yeah.
And larger communities, John, you were talking about.
But it's an impersonal thing.
It's what?
It's an impersonal thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is really good. Come tonight at 6:15. That's where we're going to start.
It's in a sense that I've done funerals for people who are well insured. They have all of that place, and then you're doing the preparing for the funeral and find out that they never had any meaningful relationships with people. I mean, they have the kids, they have the wife, everything's there, but they never, he and his wife never slept in the same room. He never knew what he had or what he missed. So I think that's kind of what I take away from this, partly the sense is you know, I value my insurance, healthcare insurance, all those insurances, and still, what is the quality of my relationships? What's the meaning of those things? Where do I really draw that value from? Well, why do I have insurance? To protect my things, protect myself, my family? What is those for? So that's kind of the question that gets raised in my
head. Yeah, in American morality, which I buy into, to not have those things means you're not being a good father or a good husband.
Right.
I mean, there's something morally deficient about you unless you are providing those protections.
Okay.
We are out of time. Let me make one final comment. And that is, the Hebrew prophets, well, first of all, you had this experience of Israel as it left Egypt. Every morning, manna appears on the ground. Right? And they're told not to collect it, not to hoard it. It will just rot. But to not be fearful, not to take things into their own hands, but to trust that God will provide every day. Okay, so you got that going on. That's a clear message of that experience. The Hebrew prophets, much later, keep showing up, telling Israel that they were more faithful to God when they were in the wilderness, depending upon that manna every day for their sustenance. That once they had arrived in the Promised Land, once they had set up their houses, their institutions, their government, they became forgetful of God. And so the prophets would show up periodically and call Israel back into the wilderness to remind it of its real and absolute dependence upon the divine. Now, I mean, that is, we can't get around that. That is a biblical, that's a dominant biblical message. This dynamic between settled city life and life in the wilderness. And it's ironic, kind of interesting that we're here in the wilderness now, that we find it rejuvenating to us to come here periodically to sort of get back into connection with what matters about life. We certainly don't have all the creature comforts that most of us probably have back at home. And there is something to that, of getting closer to kind of the rawness of life to remind ourselves of how blessed we are and how dependent we are upon God and upon divine providence. So let me just close on that note and wish you all a pleasant lunch. Tomorrow the session is on how many of our expectations and understandings of the traditional attributes of God, such as omniscience, omnipresence, omnipotence, eternity, have of late been redirected and projected onto information technology, onto computer technology, onto nanotechnology, onto memory chips, etc. And that's what the topic will be tomorrow. Okay? Thanks. Have a good day.